Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com. I'm Akiko Katema, host and producer of Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for 4 years now, and even after all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices of our network. Each week, I record my show in HRN studio because I'm excited to bring you, our listeners, the most important stories from the world of Japanese food. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Please go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio to Wordless in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Ken Fonataro, the founder and CEO of the Culture Group, which offers a unique educational programs about fermentation with a focus on Japanese and Asian-style foods. Fermented foods are increasingly popular nowadays for their deliciousness and health benefits. Ken is one of the leading experts of fermentation in the U.S. So today we'll discuss how he became fascinated by the world of fermentation, classic Japanese fermented foods that you can make at home, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Now let's start our conversation with Ken Fonataro. Hello, Ken. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Good. So first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I'm from central Jersey, from a part that's called Monmouth County. And one of the really amazing things about that part of the country and that part of New Jersey is that on one side there's the Atlantic Ocean, and about 5 miles in there's the most incredible farmland and farms. So growing up, although we were definitely not wealthy, we had access to all the benefits of nature, really. So my father and my family were fishermen. They were farmers. Both of my grandmothers were just astonishingly good chefs.
Wow.
Back then in that time, about 50 years ago, society was still pretty much set up in the way that, you know, that we were all immigrants, right? And you came to this country and you did what you could. And fortunately for both of my grandmothers, they were well trained in cooking. My French grandmother was like, could cook anything in French. My Italian German grandmother could, when she was born, on a collective up in the mountains where they would not only farm, but they would preserve foods, they would ferment foods. So there was this I come from a long tradition of doing that. And growing up, it was also traditional for the men to go out and get jobs that didn't depend on so much, you know, basically sources of to bring income in from outside of the whole farm and family establishment.
Not the cubicles.
Yeah, I mean, so, right? And one of the things that was really interesting to me is that my grandfather was actually a noted microbiologist. He was born in Maine. I believe he was a professor at Colby College for a while. And he actually, from a very, very early age, taught me all about like microbes and bacteria and
wow.
yeasts and things. He used to take me out on nature walks to both the ocean and through forests, etc. So in conjunction with my grandmothers who just, I think maybe they noticed in me the willingness and eagerness to learn about how to make everything.
Right. Well, you are not wealthy, but to me, you're the wealthiest you can think of in the
right?
world.
Right, yeah. I mean, it was paradise as far as I was concerned. And interestingly, as far as Japanese cuisine goes, my mother had a friend who, I'm not really sure why this was happening, but she would go to Japan once a year.
Wow.
And I was sort of like, okay. But she always made a point of bringing me, you know, at the time I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, back these little presents. And they're usually like food-like presents. And I can remember when I was 6 years old eating these crackers. I guess they were like typical senbai or crackers or whatever they are, and thinking, oh, my God, I have to know how to make things. These are the best things I've ever had in my life, right? And that progressed over the years where I think, you know, when I was 10, 11, 12, I started like actually asking for specific things, like demanding, oh, could you get me like some of this the next time you go to Japan? And in conjunction with, you know, at that point, my family as well, was really reaching out into the like restaurant and food industry where, you know, when my father or my mother needed someone to like babysit for the kids, it was like, okay, why don't we just bring them to work with them? So I spent a lot of time in my grandmother's bakery where my father taught me how to make breads and use yeasts when I was like 6 or 7 years old. So I think that might be where the fascination came from.
Right. Well, that's my next question. So you saved my time. Yeah, I really clearly see how you got there. So, but you started already working as an executive chef of a restaurant named the Hermitage in Boston.
The Hermitage, yeah.
And I was, it was 19 years old already. So how...
Yes.
How did it happen that you were...
Well, this is kind of an interesting story. I was going to school at Brown University, and my grandfather, the great scientist, he really wanted me to be a doctor and a scientist, etc. My mother, however, and the rest of the family really wanted me to be like a comparative literature language major because... by that point, I was speaking lots of different languages.
From your heritage.
Yeah.
Right.
And she, you know, she basically, when we were growing up, because we were still immigrants and, like, you know, you wanted to do one of the things that they instilled in kids at that age, like, you really want to do the best you can. And what you really want to do, coming from a restaurant and food service industry family, that was depending on farms, what you really wanted to do was to get out of that lifestyle, right? Like,
right.
People really didn't want their kids growing up to be, like, cooks or chefs in restaurants, right? Like, which is, it kind of presented a problem worldwide, I think, actually. But, yeah, that's...
Right. So, from being a chef, I mean, professionally cooking, and then you, I heard you got into fermentation through certain, you know, place of like behind the restaurant there's a store.
Yes, this is okay. So when I first got to college, I met this person who was very, very big in the entire restaurant industry in Boston. And one of the things that we did as friends, because he was a very wealthy person and his family was running many restaurants, his job as the youngest son of many sons was to go all over the world and to try different food at different restaurants to see how they were doing in comparison, right? So he would take me along with him. And I think I remember my sophomore year in college. By that time, I had not only experienced a lot of different kinds of foods, but I had actually ended up cooking for him and some very, I guess, well-placed people in the food service industry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them said to me one day, a very famous chef, I don't want to name drop anyone's name, but she said to me, listen, you are an extremely talented chef, and you should pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually ran that by my my grandparents at this time, and they were adamantly opposed to it. And but, you know, I guess maybe chefs are born. I don't know, but
right.
I really wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I took this letter of recommendation
mm-hmm.
that was given to me to this place called the Hermitage, which was an Imperial Russian restaurant, right?
Right.
You can't make Imperial Russian restaurant food
mm-hmm.
without this really sour plum sauce called Tekmali sauce, right?
Mm.
The thing about that is that the only place I could really source anything like that was from this place that was out the back door of the restaurant called Erewhon, right? Where what we decided to do was to use umeboshi plums for that sauce, right?
Well, actually, I looked up that, you know, famous, there's a the pages about this place.
Mm.
So natural food pioneer in the United States, that's called Erewhon.
Erewhon.
Erewhon. That's completely screwed up with the
That's from, I think, an Emerson or a Walden thing where it's supposed to be nowhere backwards or something. Or
okay,
something.
Yeah. And then it was like really a pioneer of this. Whatever he's talking about, fermentation, now kombucha, everything. But that was really the kind of pioneer.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I met Misho and Avelin Kushi,
mm-hmm.
who were obviously from Japan, who brought over George Ozawa's whole Japanese conception of macrobiotics,
mm-hmm.
Which was, at that time, a food healing system. But with them, they brought the whole... I pretty much credit the Japanese with creating, in large part, the entire, mm-hmm. like, fermentation part of the whole foods movement, which in the 60s and 70s, for example, when people like Bill Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi, who was also Japanese, went back to Japan, did this massive tour of all these, like, miso makers and shoyu makers, etc., and then created this really huge, indispensable library of foods online after they published books like the Book of Kudzu, the Book of Miso, the Book of Tempeh, you know, the Book of Natto, etc.
Right.
But I met all these people and they became my friends. So I not only adopted the macrobiotic lifestyle and followed that, but everywhere I cooked following that, I would try and introduce different fermentation techniques that were primarily Japanese fermentation techniques.
Right. Okay. So we'll take a quick break here. And after the break, we'll discuss the Japanese fermentation. So,
right.
Yep. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table,
so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcast Live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Ken Fornataro, the founder and CEO of The Culture Group, which offers unique educational programs about fermentation with a focus on Japanese and Asian style foods. So let's talk about Japanese fermentation. And I think the most essential element is koji.
Well, I would agree. I'm not so sure it's the most essential as much as it is the most spectacular.
Mm.
I mean, I know, like, you've had Jeremy San, for example, has been on here as well. And Jeremy's a friend of mine, and a lot of people who are...
Yeah, Jeremy Romansky of Lauder right, in Cleveland, in Ohio.
We call him the Koji Goat. He's right. The goat of goats. Yeah. he's spectacular,
right.
As are... there's a group of quite a few of us.
Like Richard Shee.
Rich Shee. There's also, and I want to say something about this too. For the last 2.5 years, I've actually kind of been working very closely with the Shakis, who have written several other books. But I know that Christopher actually spent a little time in Japan, right? And at a certain point, they decided that they were actually approached to write a book, right? And they actually wrote this book, which is out in 2 weeks. And this entire book is about miso, tempeh. Natto, and tempeh, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is there's obviously a big section of stuff that I did on how I use koji, why I think it's like the most spectacular, powerful...
Right.
Microbe ever. And
yeah. So could you explain what koji is for the listeners who are not familiar with?
It's actually a mold, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it basically grows all over the world. The thing about koji is that it really is very cooperative. And combined with other microbes... combined with yeasts and bacteria, it can produce spectacular things.
Mm.
And I think one of the things that the Japanese especially should be really quite proud of is that they not only adopted it as their like national fungus or whatever,
right.
But they spent hundreds of years studying it so intensely and domesticating it. Because a mold like that it can actually be a dangerous thing if it's not the right species of that mold.
Interesting. Right, that's true.
And
right.
What the Japanese did over hundreds of years was to really carefully cultivate specific molds that some of still exist only in certain areas of Japan where a certain product was made.
Mm.
Like, you know, you could go to Akita, for example, and the yeast and the koji exists in a specific wood that's only in that one place, right?
Right. Well, but the koji is known for growing well, like grows well on rice, right?
Well, any plant, actually.
Mm.
Any aspergillus. And here's the thing. If with koji especially, unless you get the right koji... it can produce these things called aflatoxins, which can ruin entire crops, which in the United States, I mean, the corn growers and even some of the rice growers are constantly fighting against this.
Mm.
The thing that the Japanese really gifted to the world was they studied it closely enough, they domesticated it, and really extensive studies now indicate that the koji that we use and the koji spores that I would highly encourage people to get directly from Japan spore makers is almost genetically impossible to create something that will kill you or harm you in any way.
Actually,
that's brilliant.
Right. In a couple of weeks, I have a koji spore producers from Japan. So I heard they have like 5,000 different kinds.
Well, that's the thing about koji too. It's like, depending on how you treat it, and depending on the environment, like I can make now koji if I like reduce the amount of air that it has exposure to, I can make it create more proteases to break down proteins than amylases, which will break down sugars.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the brilliance of koji, is that it makes so many enzymes and secondary metabolites that add flavor, that add umami, that can do things like not only clean up ocean oil spills, but if they can break down the bonds between in beans and grains, in wild roots and plants, so that all those nutrients are immediately accessible to human beings.
Wow.
I mean, it's just a brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't know that ocean cleanup.
Yes, aspect I mean, that's the amazing thing. That's another thing that Japanese should be very proud of. In 2007, they announced that they had completely determined exactly what the genetic code of Aspergillus was, Aspergillus oryzae. And since that time, using bacterial genetic sequencing tests, etc., the field of research into what codeine actually does has exploded. Right? And if you look at any of the current scientific literature on what can be done, like there's some, like, you know, there's this scientist in Japan whose name is Hideo Ibato, I think, who wrote about the industrialization and the commercialization of the production of miso, for example. And in it, he really clearly describes how, because we know so much now, instead of having to, we always have to think about the sustainability of certain processes and how something can be made and keep its integrity, but at the same time, we always have to be concerned about how much energy it takes to produce something, right? So this particular scientist discovered that, you know, the way we make amasake, for example, or the way we make shokoji, for example, they're really the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the important things that I want to emphasize about why koji is so spectacular, is that all the scientific work that they've done on it, they've realized if you take amasake, which Umansky-san, for example, is very... uses a lot.
Right. So amasake. So well, basically, you know, for listeners who's not familiar with koji, so you can make of course, Japanese sake, miso, and rice vinegar, Japanese pickles, soy sauce, and then, like, there's nothing almost like that doesn't touch koji in Japanese food categories. So amasake is a good example. So what is amasake, and what is good about it?
Well, amasake, it's primarily, there are two major contributions of Japanese fermentation and why it's not only so fascinating, you could spend your entire life just working in these. There are bean-related ferments and there are grain-related ferments.
Mm.
And on one side, you have like hamamoto and fermented soybeans, or any bean, really. And on the other side, you have rice. And for the rice part, when you're breaking down the carbohydrates or the sugars in that rice so that they're more accessible to things like yeast to make sake or to make amasake as well, you need to break down those sugars.
You sprinkle the spores of koji, grow on something that should...
Whatever you choose, but usually rice. Rice is a fantastic medium, right?
So the... You know, whatever surface started to be broken down because of koji that eats whatever they got stuck to. So that creates some reaction.
Enzymes. Right. What that does is create enzymes. Koji is well known. I mean, we've identified about 3,000 different enzymes that koji can create.
Right.
And it's spectacular. I mean, depending on what you want to make with it, you can make amasake, right? But almost using the same exact technique, except allowing, like, for some lactic bacteria to invade the Yamasake, you can then make sake,
mm-hmm.
or you can just like not go that far and make Doboroku.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's the really brilliant thing about Amasake in particular.
Right. So Doboroku, by the way, is kind of a speakeasy kind of sake.
Okay,
right.
That's like country style sake, which I'm sure it's not. Well, some places in Japan can make it, but legally it's they discourage you from doing that from home because, you know, Japan is one of those countries where they have to, you know, they've gone through famines at times and they have to really control, you know, what's good for the country and what can, you know, mm-hmm. be output as far as making sake, et cetera, because,
right.
you know, it's a huge source of revenue in
mm-hmm.
the country, so
right.
you have to be really careful about that. And they do it really well, too.
Right.
So,
yeah.
you
so
know,
national
you know,
mindset.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
so the, going back to amazake, amazake is basically, it's a, you know, the rice.
Rice broken down into like a sweet pudding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A sweet rice pudding. You can use that instead of sugar, right?
Mm.
And it still has alive digestive enzymes in it, right?
Mm.
So that's why if you were worried about like sugar intake, et cetera, use amazake, and that will help you slowly digest not only those sugars, but I mean, because they're already pre-digested. That's one of the brilliant things about Japanese fermentation and fermentation in general, is that these things are pre-digested, right? Because the code just keeps counting stuff up, right? Even after it's done, right, you're not going to kill
right.
the important enzymes that have been created.
Mm.
Right?
So in a way, it's digesting food for you.
That's
so,
right.
So that you are, your work is half done by...
Yeah, that's right. And that holds true for beans as well.
Mm. So
that's
it's like a miso.
Thing.
Miso,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Miso, right. All miso is probably made with soybeans. So...
And rice.
Right.
Koji, usually, right?
Right. right. So that's a combination, and you can add more barley or, you know, just by miso. So that kind of thing. So miso is another thing. And can you make miso at home?
Oh, yeah.
yeah.
So, actually, as I was saying, this whole book mm-hmm. is about how to make, like, 25 different types of miso,
mm-hmm.
25 different types of koji. I mean, this is really quite a spectacular work, and people are... around the world really contributed a lot of their life's work to this book. It's really quite spectacular, actually.
Right. So it's miso tempeh natto.
Yeah, it's okay. by the Shakis.
Right.
And
okay. All right. So, but, you know, I think it's miso used to be everybody was making a home. Like, new bride had their own family
right.
taste. And
right,
they have to adjust it to the new family taste, that kind of thing. So how long does it take to make miso?
I can make a miso in probably 7 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, it really depends. Miso, see, that's the really fascinating thing about koji. It's like, depending on how you manipulate it, right? I mean, in miso, just like sake, just like shoyu, has to undergo a certain process. And, in the past, it used to be all about seasons, right? The weather and the humidity would dictate what happened in both the sake and the miso, etc. Like, you want, at first, the very first thing you want to do is to create lactic acid bacteria so that, basically, that clears the way for all the good yeasts that you want in there, right, to develop. And then, over time, what happens is the actual... koji, with all of its different enzymes, will start to break things down slowly over time. And that's why you're never going to be able to replace something like hacho miso, for example, or some of the longer-aged misos. But there are ways that we know now, because of scientific advances, that you can accelerate processes. Like with sake... you have the sokujo type of thing where now I think almost most sake makers will just add lactic acid to their shubos or mozus at the start. You can do that with misos as well. If you look at some of the misos that are available on the market. They're adding either specific yeast that would take a long time to develop in them, or they're adding a little bit of, you know, some people are adding the B vitamins that the yeast would make over time. But yeah, I mean, in the past, miso making was like this great community event, and everyone got together and they did it, and it really created strong cultural bonds. It was a tradition, and I think that people really need to get back into doing that together, everywhere. But yeah, you
can. So that's why I just want to mention quickly. Well, unfortunately, today's show has to be a little, you know, shorter. But yeah, so you have the group called the Culture Group, which is educational, like program provider that you organize. So, so I know that last class, for instance, we had in May, you taught people how to make miso, how to make shiokoji, which is you know, koji and grown salt and rice. And I made it before. That's pretty easy. And everything after marinating in shiokoji, it's everything is magically tasty. And it's like a miso dama. It's like a, you know, quick instant version of real miso. Like, you know, you put some ingredients in it so you could have like all those things in the fridge. You can quickly make a miso soup, right? That's the idea. And you have other interesting pickles and all those teaching. So, yeah, is it available to everybody?
Yes. Yeah, whatever we do is, what we're doing is, we really kind of took a little time out to help out with this book, but what we're doing now is we're posting on our website, culturesgroup.net, all of our recipes that we've, over the last 40 years, have been developing. Some are pretty unique, and a lot of them are trying to educate people about the ways in which everything is pretty much basically similar, right? And all the recent scientific studies as well are now showing that Japanese really knew what they were doing, right? Even hundreds of years ago, before they had microscopes or anything else, and they knew that allowing certain things to occur just would turn out a certain way.
Right. Out of necessity, too, because
they
had
course,
to make everything useful
without
throwing things away.
I mean, we for example, we use corn to make koji, to make miso, to make baked goods, etc. And in the past, that was kind of considered an inferior thing to make koji with, like in Japan. I mean, maybe like in Shinjuku, for example, they might be a little better known as using corn for that purpose. But all of these fermentations really are based on the need to survive.
Well, it sounds great, though. Corn.
It's fantastic. It really, really is.
I'll try that.
Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So, so basically, your website is culturegroup.net, not .com. .net.
.net, yeah. Right. We're a net group.
Right. So the book, before we close, let me see, the title, Miso, Tempeh, Natto, and Other Tasty Ferments, Step-by-Step Guide to Fermenting Grains and Beans.
Yeah.
So the authors are Kristen Shoki and Christopher Shoki.
Yes.
And you contribute to the book as well.
Oh, yeah. There's a big section that I do. There's a big section that Rich She does. There's a big section from Jeremy Umansky. There's a big section from Cheryl Passwater from Contraband Ferments. Yonan Tani-san and from who owns NY Nurture. She's a doctor who
and Yonan Tani.
Right. Who makes natto.
So it sounds like it's like a collection of the knowledge of
But this is really the references, the background research that was done for this book is incredible.
Okay.
I mean, they have read just about every paper that's come out scientifically as well. And they really also get into the whole nutritional benefits of fermented foods.
All right. So it's coming out soon?
In 2 weeks. Okay. Exactly, in 2 weeks. Yeah.
All right. So listeners, miso, tempeh, natto. Yeah. All right, so we have to wrap up. And so again, Ken's website is culturegroup.net, and it's a lot of
Cultures Group.
Cultures Group. Plural, culturesgroup.net.
Right.
All right. So, thank you so much for joining us today. And maybe you can join us again.
I would love that. Yeah, I'm so sorry. I mean, the weather.
Yeah.
We can control the weather. Right.
So, okay. All right. So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritagevideonetwork.org or at kikukatema.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritagevideonetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.